one do you want to die at? If you allow the economy to determine your choice and which action you'll take, you will never, ever be in control of your own economy. The solution? Get off your sofa, get out of your home, and make your way into the market. Get in front of your clients, seek out new opportunities, seek out old opportunities. Show them that you're advancing into the market. Only retreat briefly, only long enough to shore up your resources so that you can prepare for what? To expand again with more action, more energy, more effort, and more persistence. Your energy, efforts, creativity, and personality are worth more than the dollars that men create and machines print. And although spending money is the most common way for a business to expand, it is certainly not the only way. And it is not nearly as valuable as a human being or a group of human beings taking 10x actions consistently and persistently. Remember 10x, baby. You want to expand with the goal of dominating your sector and getting attention by taking massive action. Only then will you be able to expand your contacts, your influences, your connections, and visibility with the goal, with the obsession of creating new problems. You will then continue to expand until everyone, including your supposed competitors, knows you are the dominant 10x player in the market, and they will always associate your name with what it is they do. Exercise. What are some ways you can expand that only require energy and creativity, but not money? I mentioned that there's only one time when you should contract. What was it? And for how long? When have you ever benefited from contraction? Has it ever benefited you? I want you to write those down. And lastly, when have you expanded your efforts and what results did you see? Chapter 15, burn the place down. Once you take 10x actions and start getting traction, you must continue to add wood to your fire until you either start a brush fire or a bonfire or, hey, burn the place down. Don't rest and don't stop ever. I learned this the hard way after achieving a lot of success and then resting on my laurels for a moment. This is a commonly made mistake. Do not do it. Keep stacking wood until the fire is so hot and burns so brightly that not even your competitors, not even market changes can put the fire out. Your fire has to continue to be stoked, and that means more wood, more fuel, and in your case, more actions. Once you start operating like this, it will become almost second nature to continue because you're going to be winning. You're going to continue with new actions. It's easiest and most natural to continue taking massive actions when you're winning. And winning is only possible with more massive actions. When you begin to see things heat up, you'll quickly become aware, even obsessed, with the possibilities before you and will start to see new levels of positive results. Your actions will start to perpetuate themselves like a flywheel that, once it gets going, continues going by itself. Newton talked about the law of inertia. An object in motion continues to stay in motion. Hey, keep taking action until you can't stop your forward momentum. You might even find yourself operating on less sleep, less food, because you're literally subsisting on your adrenaline generated by your victories. It will be about this time that people will start offering you their admiration and then their advice. Now, be particularly aware or wary of those who suggest that you've done enough or who advise you to take a little rest or, hey, it's time to take a vacation. Now is not the time for rest and celebration or vacations. It's time for more action. Andy Grove, one of the Intel Corporation's first employees, coined the saying, "Only the paranoid survive." And although I'm not recommending that you spend your entire career in a state of paranoia, I do believe that you must stay committed to taking action. Even after achieving success along the way, continue to take more actions in order to achieve and exceed your goals. The time to celebrate or take vacations will come. Right now, you must keep adding wood until the fire's burning so hot that no one and nothing can put out your success. One of the problems with success is that it demands continuous attention. Success tends to bless those who are most committed to giving it the most attention. Success is somewhat like a lawn or a garden. No matter how green it gets or how beautiful the flowers, you must continue to tend it. You have to keep mowing, trimming, edging, watering, and planting. Otherwise, your grass will turn brown and the flowers will die. That's the case for success. There's no retreating for those who want to create it and keep it. Look, it's a myth to believe that the successful get to kick back and stop making the very efforts that brought them their fulfillment in the first place. Always keep the four actions: doing nothing, retreating, taking an average amount of action, and taking massive action. Keep them in mind. The 10X rule means you're going to create success in quantities great enough that you're constantly in total control. The wannabes and people who get close are the ones who quit. They quit adding wood and they back off. Massive action is designed to move you past your peers, past the wannabes, and off the treadmill. The best way to quit worrying about your competition, the best way to eliminate uncertainty, is to build a fire so large and so hot that everyone in the world, even your competition, comes to sit by your fire for warmth. Keep in mind, most competition is created by those who are unwilling to operate at the higher levels of action, those who are merely imitating the efforts of others. There can never be enough wood on your fire. You can never take too much action or accumulate too much success. There is no such thing as being talked or written about excessively, being covered too frequently, or receiving too much authority, or working too much. These are simply claims that mediocre people make in order to justify their own decision to be happy with the status quo. How can you ever take too much action when you have an endless ability to create new action? Look at the big players on this planet. None of them ever run out of energy, effort, people, ideas, or resources. They enjoy the gifts of abundance because they create abundance in their enterprises. So instead of resenting these people, hating them, man, admire and emulate them. If you do, you'll find that the more you commit to new actions, the more creative you will become. It is though your imagination opens up, new possibilities pour out from new commitments. It is not even necessarily the creativity that is so brilliant, but the ability to take massive action that prompts the brilliance. I recently met with a very, very high-profile PR firm in Los Angeles whose members suggested in this meeting that I might possibly or should be concerned with the concept of overexposure. Something I thought was an extremely strange concept. The notion of overexposure, I'm sure you've heard this, the idea that you can see or hear about someone too much or about a product too much. This is based on a concept that a person doesn't continue to generate new ideas and new products. The underlying belief is that an overexposed person or an overexposed product will somehow lose its value. But consider the following. Coca-Cola is known by almost everyone on planet Earth. You can find Coca-Cola's products in almost every store, bar, airplane, and hotel in the world. Is it overexposed? Should it hide its products? Should the company hold back in fear that Coca-Cola will lose its value because too many people are hearing about it, it's too easy to get, or maybe too many people are using it? This seems to be fairly ridiculous to me. And there are countless other examples of products and companies that prove this point. Microsoft, Starbucks, McDonald's, Wells Fargo, Google, Fox TV, Marlboro, Walgreens, Exxon, Apple, Toyota, even some athletic and celebrity personalities. Overexposure for most of you is not the problem. Obscurity is the problem. Remember, if you don't know me, then it doesn't matter how good my product is or how low my price is. Remember, if you don't know or know about me, then it doesn't matter how good my product is or how much it will do for you or how low the price is. And even if overexposure was a true problem, which is not, look, I'd still rather be overexposed than face obscurity. The sad but true fact is that most people don't even get in the neighborhood of overexposure. Most people never get inspired enough to build a bonfire so hot that others come to it. They're either miseducated, socially programmed to settle for less, or fear that their actions will somehow get them out of control. I promise you, this will not happen to you. You must build your fire so big and so hot that you not only burn the house down, at least willing to burn the house down, but you incinerate everything in your path. Go all the way, go all in, and then keep going all in until your fire burns so hot that people stand around your fire in admiration of your ability to take action. Don't worry about the resistance you're afraid you'll face from either the market or your competitors. they'll get out of your way once they see you're a force to be reckoned with. Exercise. What is the fire that you've always wanted to start and need to add wood to? What three things could you do to add wood to that fire today? Who can you get support from in order to continue stoking your fire? Chapter 16, Fear is the Great Indicator. Sooner or later, you will experience fear when you start taking new actions at new levels. In fact, if you aren't, then you're probably not doing enough of the right things. Fear isn't bad or something to be avoided. Conversely, it's something you want to seek and then to embrace. Fear is actually a sign that you're doing what is needed to move in the right direction. Look, an absence of concerns should signal that you are only doing that which you're comfortable with. And that will only get you more of what you have right now. As strange as it may sound, you want to be scared until you have to push yourself to new levels to experience new fears again. In fact, the only thing that scares me is a complete lack of fear. What is fear anyway? I mean, really, does it even exist? Is it real? I know it feels real when you're experiencing it, but admit it, most of the time, what you fear doesn't even occur. It's been said that fear stands for false events appearing real, which aptly implies that most of what you're afraid of doesn't even come to pass. Fear, for the most part, is provoked by emotions, not rational thinking. And in my humble estimation, emotions are wildly overrated and the scapegoat many people use for their failure to act. But regardless of whether you agree with my opinion on emotions, you must reframe your understanding of this one emotion called fear and use fear as a reason to move forward rather than as an excuse to stop or retreat. Use this frequently avoided feeling as a green light, this thing called fear. Use it as a green light to signal you of what you should do. Chances are that when you were a child, you found fear in irrational things, the boogeyman under the bed, for example. It was an indicator to check your closet and the dark corners of your room to see what was lurking. But as all children eventually find, the boogeyman does not exist anywhere except in the child's mind. Adults have their own boogeymen, the unknown, rejection, failure, fear of success, and on and on. And these boogeymen should be assigned to take action as well. For example, if you're afraid to call a client, then it's that sign that you should call that client. Fear of speaking with the boss is an indication you should march into his office and ask for a moment of his time. Fear of requesting the client's business means that you must ask for the client's business and then keep asking. The 10X rule compels you, forces you to separate yourself from everyone else in the market. And you do that by, as I emphasized earlier, doing what others refuse to do. Remember, only actions. Only in this way will you distinguish yourself and dominate your sector. Everyone experiences fear on some level. And because the marketplace is composed of other people experiencing fear, interacting with both products and one another, look, the market will face fear in the same way that you and your peers do. But rather than seeing fear as a sign to run, as most other people in the market will, it must become your indicator to move, to go forward. Now, I handled this dilemma myself by omitting time from the equation, since time actually fuels fear. It drives fear. The more time you devote to the object of your apprehension, the stronger the fear becomes. So what I do is I starve my fear of its favorite food, time, by removing time from its menu. For example, let's say that John needs to make a call to a client, a task that immediately causes him to feel anxiety. Rather than picking up the phone and making the call immediately, John goes and gets a cup of coffee and thinks about what he's going to say or do. His lengthy contemplation only causes the fear to grow as he imagines all the ways the call could go badly and then all the potentially terrible things that might happen. If confronted, he's likely to claim that he needs to prepare before he makes the call. But preparation is merely an excuse for those who haven't been trained properly and who use it as a reason to justify their last-minute reluctance. You know what John needs to do? John needs to take a deep breath, pick up the phone, and make the call. Last-minute preparation is just another way to feed fear that will only get stronger as time is added. Nothing happens without action. Fear doesn't just tell you what to do. It also tells you when to do it. Ask yourself, what time is it? at any point in the day, and the answer is always the same. The time is now. The time is always now. And when you experience fear, it's a sign that the best time to take action is at that very moment. Most people will never follow through with their goals when enough time has passed from the inception of their idea to actually doing something about that idea. However, if you remove time, when you remove time from that process, you'll be ready to fire. There's simply no other choice than to act. There's no need to prepare. It's too late at that moment once you've gotten this far. Now, the only thing that will make a difference in that moment of fear is action. Everyone has had the experience of failing to do something they wanted to do. Perhaps by the time you got yourself ready to do something, someone else had taken action already. And now, that's what you're regretting. Failure comes in many forms. It occurs whether you act or you don't act. Regardless of the outcome, I would say it's far preferable to fail while doing something than to fail by over-preparing while someone else walks up and scoops up your dreams. This scenario occurs in business every day. People give their fears much more time than they deserve. They feed it with time. They wait to make the personal visit. They wait to make the phone call. They wait to write the email or present their proposal because they're afraid of the outcome. Look, countless individuals share the same excuses for why it is not a good time to take action. The client's leaving town. The client just got back in town. It's the end of the month. It's the beginning of the month. The client's been in meetings all day. They're about to go into a meeting. They just bought something. They don't have the budget. They're cutting back. Business is bad. There's been a change in management or staff. I don't want to bug them. They never return my phone calls anyway. No one else can sell them. They're unrealistic. I don't know what to say. I'm not ready yet. I just called them yesterday, and on and on. Look, all the excuses in the world will not change one simple fact, that fear is a sign to do whatever it is you fear and do it quickly. My wife tells me all the time, "You seem fearless. How do you do that? I want to be fearless like you." The truth is actually quite the contrary. I am scared most of the time. However, I refuse to feed fear with time and allow it to get stronger on me. I opt instead to get things done quickly as fast as possible. I've learned that it's simply better for me to take the quick approach, even if I'm unprepared. You will experience the same thing when you're finally able to take the plunge, man. Just push through the fear. In fact, you'll be amazed how much stronger you become over time and how much more confident you are to do new things. Taking massive action quickly and repeatedly will ensure that you appear fearless in the marketplace. The person who takes action on whatever he or she fears the most will be the person who advances his or her cause the most. Let the rest of the marketplace submit to anxiety and prepare unnecessarily for false events appearing real. Look, you got a job to do. Remember, fear is one of the most disabling emotions a human being can experience. It immobilizes people, and often it ultimately prevents them from going for their goals and their dreams. Everyone fears something in life. However, it's what each of us do with that fear that distinguishes us from the others. When you allow fear to set you back, you lose energy, you lose momentum, and you lose confidence, and your fears only grow. Have you ever watched some kind of performer eat fire? It appears that the trick here is to completely exhaust the oxygen that the fire requires for life. When the fire eater pulls away too early, the oxygen refuels the fire, which will then, of course, burn the fire eater. The same is true with fear. If you back off from it, even the slightest bit, if you give it even the slightest bit of oxygen that it needs to stay alive, it will get bigger. So commit yourself entirely. Remove time from the equation, and you will snuff out your fears and be able to take more action. Eat your fears. Don't feed them by backing off or giving them time to grow. Eat them. Learn to look for them and use fear so that you know exactly what you need to do to overcome them and then advance your life. Every successful person I know of has used fear as an indicator to determine which actions will provide them with the greatest return. I use fear in my own life every chance I get to remain aware that I am growing and expanding myself. Look, if you're not experiencing fear, you're not taking new action and you're not growing. It's as simple as that. It does not take money or luck to create a great life. It requires the ability to move past your fears with speed and power. Fear, like fire, is something from which you should never pull away. Rather, it should be something you use to fuel the actions of your life. Exercise. What are your three biggest fears? Number two, whom do you fear contacting who could help you or improve your business? And number three, what did you learn about fear in this chapter? Chapter 17, The Myth of Time Management. I should begin this chapter by admitting that I do not consider myself a great manager by any means. Neither have I been a great planner. In fact, I've never even written a business plan in my life for any of my businesses. However, I've always been able to effectively manage myself well enough to build multiple companies from scratch that are profitable. Time management has never been something I considered valuable for myself, even though I do spend time on those things that I think are most valuable. I often receive questions about time management and balance in my seminars. I have found throughout my career that the people who are most concerned with time management and balance in their lives are the very same people who believe in notions of shortages that we discussed in the earlier chapters. Most don't even know how much time is available to them or what tasks are most necessary to accomplish in the time they have. Look, if you don't know how much time you have or need, then how on earth can you expect to manage time and balance it? The first thing you must do is to make success your duty by setting distinct and definitive priorities. I can't do this for you. Of course, everyone's priorities are different. However, if success is a main concern for you, then I would suggest that you spend most of your time doing those things that will create success. Of course, I don't know what success means in your life. It could involve a variety of people and things, finances, family, happiness, spirituality, physical or emotional well-being, or if you're like me, it would include all of them. And remember, it can be all of them for you. I personally am not interested in balance in my life. I am interested in abundance in every area. I don't think I should have to sacrifice one in favor of another. Look, successful people think in terms of all, whereas unsuccessful tend to place limits on themselves and think in terms of one or the other. They may believe that if I'm rich, I can't be happy. Or if I thrive in my career, then I won't have time to be a good father, a good husband, or a spiritual person. In fact, it's interesting to me to notice that the people who put limits on them the most about what is available to them are also the most inclined to talk about balance. However, this is a flawed manner of thinking that neither time management nor balance will resolve. Look, as far as I'm concerned, it's pointless for people to worry about time management and balance. The question they should be asking is, how can I have it all in abundance? Successful people have attained the things they desire in quantity so great that no one can take them away from them. And how can a person consider him or herself successful if he or she isn't happy? What happiness is there in being unable to pay the bills or provide for your family or worry about your future? The moment you achieve one goal you've set for yourself, then it's time to establish a new target. Quit thinking in terms of either or and start thinking in terms of all and everything. That's right. Quit thinking in terms of either or and start thinking in terms of all and everything. As I was writing this, a client sent me a message asking, "Man, do you ever rest?" I jokingly wrote him back seconds later, "Never." I do, of course, like every other human being. However, I know how much time is available to me. I know what my priorities are, and I know it is my duty, my obligation, and my responsibility to go after them in the time I have. I challenge you to keep track of how you're first spending your time, your available time, and maybe journal it. Most people have no clue what they even do with their time, but then complain that they don't have enough time. Did you know that every single person has 168 hours in a week? And based on a typical 40-hour work week, typical, the average U.S. employee only works 37 and a half hours of the 168 hours available, with 30 minutes for lunch each day. And it's pretty unlikely that most people actually even work the average 37 and a half hours. In fact, the average individual spends 22.3% of his or her available time at work, 33.3% asleep, and 16.6 in front of a TV or online. And those comparisons assume that the person spends 100% of his or her time at work actually working. Then these very same people worry about balance and time management. But an imbalance is always going to occur when you don't do enough with the time you have. While most people claim to value time, most, in fact, don't seem to know very much about time. Like, who creates time? Do you create your own time, or does someone else do that for you? What can you do to create more time? What does the expression, time is money, mean? How do you treat time to make sure your time is money? What is the most important thing that you should do with your time? See, all these questions are worthy of your consideration and require your attention in order for you to maximize time. Now, let's assume that you have 75 years to live in this lifetime. That's approximately 657,000 hours, or 39,420,000 minutes. Take any given day of the week, you have an average of 3,900 Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, etc. Now, here's the scary part of it. If you're 37 years old, as you listen to this, then did you know you only have 1,950 Wednesdays left? What if you only had $1,950 left in your bank? Would you watch it slip away, or would you do whatever you could to increase it? I believe that I can do more with 1,950 weeks than most people will ever do. The only way to increase time is to get more done in the time you have. Look, if I could get 15 phone calls done in 15 minutes and you get 15 phone calls done in 1 hour, then I've essentially created 45 minutes for myself. In this way, the 10X rule makes it possible to multiply time. That's right. The 10X rule makes it possible to actually multiply and control time. If I hire someone and pay that person $15 an hour to make 15 calls every 15 minutes, then I duplicated my efforts and my time then becomes money. To really understand, manage, maximize, and squeeze every opportunity out of the time you have to fully understand and appreciate how much time you have available. You must first take control of your time, not allow others to do so. If you listen to people discuss the topic of time, especially in regards to the amount they have at work, you'll probably hear a lot of complaining. People act as though work is something to get through, yet in reality, they spend very little of their time at work. Most people only work enough to make it feel like work, whereas successful people work at a pace that gets such satisfying results that work is a reward. Truly successful people don't even call it work. For them, it's a passion, a hobby, something they want to do. Why? Because they do it enough to win. An easy way to achieve balance is to simply work harder while you're at the office. This won't just leave you with more time. It will allow you to experience the rewards of your job and make it feel less like work and more like success. Try to take this approach. Be grateful to go to work and see how much you can get done in the time you have. Make it a race, a challenge. Make it fun. The first thing you do when managing time and seeking balance is to decide what is important for you. In which areas do you want to achieve success and in what quantities? Write down those things in order of importance, then determine the total amount of time you have available and decide where you're going to allot time to each of these endeavors. Another thing to do is log how you are spending your time daily, and I mean every single second. This will allow you to see all the ways in which you are wasting time, those little bad habits and those activities that in no way can contribute to your success. Any action that is not adding wood to your fire should be considered wasteful. Think Xbox, online poker, watching television, napping, drinking, taking smoking breaks. The potential list is endless. Brutal, isn't it? Yes, it is. But look, if you don't manage your time, I promise you that you'll waste your time. Of course, things will change throughout the course of your life and in your career. You'll get older. You achieve and then generate new goals. Different things and people will enter your world. All these changes require that you continue to modify your priorities. For example, I listened for years to parents who told me I didn't understand how to balance work with family because I didn't have children of my own. Well, I recently had my first child, most assuredly an event that demands more of my time, and was able to experience this for myself. What I found was not a problem with balance or work, but rather a solution based on priorities. My daughter merely gave me another reason to create success, not an excuse to avoid working more. She is sheer motivation for me to do well because now I'm doing it for her as well as for myself. Look, you can't blame your family for keeping you from creating the success you deserve. They should be the reason you want to succeed at a bigger level. It might seem difficult, but there are always ways to make things work. Get yourself and your family members on a schedule that allows you to do those things that are a priority for you and them. For example, my solution when I had my daughter was to add 1 hour to each of my days in order to spend time with my daughter. My wife and I met and we created a schedule that will allow me to have time with my daughter and my wife and not negatively impact the work schedule, the production schedule that provides for our financial success. The first thing my wife and I did was build our daughter's sleep schedule around our priorities. We agreed that I would get up 1 hour earlier each day and take my daughter on an outing, just me and her. This would ensure that I would have quality time when I'm home with my daughter before I go to the office and before I become consumed by the day's events. It also would allow my wife some extra time to sleep in. Now, I've been doing this with my daughter since she was about 6 months old, and it works beautifully. Each morning, I take my daughter to the grocery store with me and introduce her to all the people who work there at the grocery store. When I get back from our outing, the rest of the day is mine to produce in the business world uninterrupted. Because I get my daughter up so early, we're then in a position to put her to bed before 7 p.m. each night. Then my wife and I are able to spend quality time at the end of the day, not interrupted by a young child. We understand that this system will continue to change as my daughter grows older and that alterations will have to be made in it. However, the point is that we're controlling our time rather than just haphazardly trying to manage time. Our decision to set priorities and commit to a solution lets us be the boss, owners, the controllers of our own time. The busier you become in life, the more you have to manage, control, and prioritize. Although I certainly don't have this to some scientific formula that will magically make this easier, I can tell you one thing. If you start with a commitment to success and then agree to control time, you will create an agenda that will accommodate how you use time. You have to decide first how you're going to use your time. You must command, control, and squeeze every second of it in order to increase your footprint and dominate the marketplace. Get everyone necessary, your family, your colleagues, your associates, employees, to recognize and agree upon those priorities which are most important to you. If you don't do this, you will have people with different agendas pulling you in all sorts of directions. My schedule works for me because everyone in my life, from my wife to the people who work with me, know what is most important to me and understands how I value time. This allows us to handle everything else that comes our way. In our culture, we're frequently encouraged to slow down, relax, take it easy, find balance, and just be happy with where we are and then with what we have. Although this can sound great in theory, it can be very difficult for people who abandon every decision to ever be in control of their lives. Look, most people can't simply relax and take it easy since they never do enough to free themselves of the meager existence that comes as a result of mediocre actions. Work should provide a purpose, a mission, and a sense of accomplishment. These things are vital to every single person's mental, emotional, and physical well-being. People who promote the new age esoteric advice to slow it down, take it easy, are encouraging a mindset that isn't doing anyone any good. Consider the types of traits this thinking has created in people. Laziness, procrastination, a lack of urgency, sloth, tendency to blame others, irresponsibility, entitlement, excuses, and the expectation that it's up to someone else to solve our problems. Wake up. No one's going to save you. No one is going to take care of your family or your retirement. No one is going to make things work out for you. The only way to do so is to utilize every moment of every day at 10x levels. Only this will ensure that you accomplish your goals and your dreams. Happiness, security, confidence, and fulfillment come from utilizing your gifts and energy to achieve whatever you've decided is success for you. And it requires every bit of your time, which is yours and only yours, to control. Exercise. How much time are you at work each day? Second part of this, what percentage of the time that you're at work does that represent of your total day? How much time do you spend on wasteful activities? TV, smoking, drinking, sleeping, oversleeping, getting coffee, having lunches, or meetings with no business opportunity? What are some of your time wasters? What has this chapter taught you about time? Chapter 18, criticism is a sign of success. Although getting criticized is certainly not the best feeling in the world, I have great news. Receiving criticism is a surefire sign that you're well on your way to success. Criticism is not something you want to avoid. Rather, it's what you must expect to come your way once you start hitting it big. Criticism is defined as the judgment of the merits and faults of the work or actions of one individual by another. Although criticizing doesn't necessarily mean to imply fault, the word is often taken to mean prejudice or disapproval. The dictionary, however, fails to include the following helpful bits of information. When you start taking the right amounts of action and therefore creating the right amounts of success for you, criticism is often not far behind. Of course, most people don't like being criticized. However, I have found that it comes as a natural result of getting attention. This may be why some people avoid attention in the first place, as an attempt to then dodge judgment or criticism. However, look, there's no way to achieve serious levels of success without getting attention. Yes, people will eye you and make it clear that they disapprove of what you're doing. Let's face it, no matter what choices you make in life, someone is going to criticize you somewhere along the way. Wouldn't you rather receive it from people who are jealous of your success than from your family or your boss or bill collectors for not taking enough action and creating enough success? Look, when you start taking enough action, it won't be long before you're judged by people who aren't taking enough action. If you're generating substantial success, people will start to pay attention to you. Some will admire you. Some will want to learn from you. But unfortunately, most will envy you and criticize you. These are the people whose excuses for not doing enough will morph into reasons why what you are doing is actually wrong. You need to expect and anticipate criticism as one of the signs of success. It will come when you start cranking at these 10x levels, often before your accomplishment is even evident. Beware. This criticism can come in many forms. It may first show up as advice from others. Why are you spending so much energy on that one client? You know, he never buys anything. Or you might hear, you know, you should really enjoy life more. It's not all work, you know. These are the kinds of things that people start to say to you to make themselves feel better because your abundance of activity highlights their deficiency of activity. Remember, success is not a popularity contest. It is your duty, your obligation, and your responsibility. A buddy of mine who's in the fence business in Louisiana once admitted to me, Grant, I don't want attention. The minute I get attention, the competitors start coming after me. I want to fly under the radar so no one knows what I'm doing. Now, although that's certainly one way to approach your success, you can't fly under the radar for too long and expect to ever make it to the top. Laying low in order to avoid attention and consequently criticism probably means that you're holding yourself back to some degree. Your fear of being attacked is keeping you from going for it completely. However, once the naysayers realize and acknowledge that you aren't going away and that your success is something they should imitate, not judge, they will give up and find someone else to criticize. Weak and overwhelmed individuals respond to others' success by attacking it with criticism. The moment you elect to dominate or acquire territory, you run the risk of becoming a target for these people. You see this in politics constantly. When neither side has any real solution, they merely distract all of us by just criticizing and laying into one another. It doesn't do anyone any good. Criticism of any individual or group should be a signal to the recipient that the person flinging mud is threatened by the entity he or she is actually belittling. People who habitually disparage others with criticism like this usually don't have a solution to their own situation except to degrade another. The only way to handle criticism is to foresee it as an element of your success formula. Much like fear, it's a sign that you're making the right moves in the right volumes, getting enough attention, and making a big enough splash. One of my clients recently called my company to complain that my staff was following up with him too aggressively. I called to ask him what the problem was. After listening to him malign my employees for doing what was essentially their job, I said to John, "Knock it off. These people are simply doing what they know is right because they know we can help you. The fact that you haven't made a decision to move forward and haven't pulled the trigger is what should be criticized here. But I will refrain from doing so because it won't do either of us any good. Now let's stop the negativity and do something positive to move your company forward." I then rewarded my staff for aggressively following up with my client. Receiving complaints about too much follow-up is an indication that my staff is moving in the right direction, not the wrong one. I refused to allow the client's protest to stop us and supported my staff in their efforts. We all understand at my office that criticism is part of the success cycle. I won't apologize for any employee of mine who is seeking success. And in case you're wondering, we did close the deal. This very same client now tells people with admiration and praise that those guys follow up like maniacs. When I finished college, I got a full-time sales job rather than taking a position in the area in which I had received my degree. Within a couple of years, my sales results had taken me to the very top 1% of all the salespeople in that industry and way ahead of the people with whom I worked directly. And if you think they didn't criticize me, well, think again. Of course they did. They made jokes about me, poked fun at me, tried to distract me, and even tried to convince me to cease the very actions that had gotten me to where I was. That's what lower performers do. That's what average performers do. They make others wrong for doing what is necessary in order to make themselves feel okay with what they're doing. The highest performers, the winners, respond by studying successful people and duplicating how successful people got successful. They train themselves to reach the top performer level. Because lower performers are not willing to step up and take responsibility to increase their production, they can only seek out to tear down those who are performing at the higher levels. When my book, If You're Not First, You're Last, hit the New York Times bestseller list, some of my supposed competition immediately began criticizing me. One person called the book's title arrogant. Another asked, "Who does Cardone think he is?" Yet another suggested that I was getting too big for my own good, whatever the hell that means. One person even called to tell me to get a new editor because he claimed that the grammar was wrong. Did I pay attention to any of these comments? Not for a second. I had a New York Times bestseller. From what I can tell, criticism precedes admiration, and like it or not, goes hand in hand with success. First comes the criticism, then the admiration, and then the success. So keep pouring on the success, and sooner or later, the very same people who are putting you down will be admiring you for what you have done. Those who have initially judged your actions will later be singing your praises. Just as long as you take the criticism as a sign of your growing success and keep the accelerator on your actions at 10x levels. After all, what better way to retaliate against criticism than to keep succeeding? Exercise. What have you learned about criticism now? 2. What criticism would you most like to hear from others? 3. Give 3 examples of when you have seen people go from criticizing others to then admiring them. Chapter 19, Customer Satisfaction is the Wrong Target. The topic of criticism provides an appropriate segue into a discussion about what I believe to be the overused and abused concept of customer satisfaction. One of the first protests I hear from people to whom I promote the idea of 10x actions is their concern that customer satisfaction will somehow be damaged. They worry that if they and their company push too much or become overly aggressive, they'll somehow hurt their brand's reputation in the marketplace. Although I suppose that's possible, it's much more likely due to the overabundance of products and organizations available today that no one will even know about you or your company or notice your brand in the first place. The board of trustees of a national cable channel I was working with became concerned that a new show that the executives were very excited about did not fit the network's brand. I told them, if you don't start bringing TV to people's homes that is current and relevant and that people have to tune into, you ain't gonna have a brand to defend. When you fail to find supporters, establish customers, secure investors, and close the deal because you failed to do whatever it takes to get the job done, then you hide under the excuse of protecting your brand and customer satisfaction. You just as soon have a shovel in your hand and dig your own grave. Customer service is the wrong target. Increasing customers is the right target. This doesn't mean customer satisfaction isn't important. Everyone knows that customers have to be satisfied and happy in order for them to return and give a positive word of mouth to others. If your service or product or investment isn't built on satisfaction, you're a criminal. And this book will only land you in jail sooner or later. Make your primary focus commanding attention and generating new customers before you worry about making them happy. Let me explain simply. Customer satisfaction doesn't concern me and my company very much. Why? Because I know we over-deliver to our clients and provide customer service that is well beyond satisfactory. We over-deliver to every client, and we never say no until we absolutely have to. We don't even talk about customer satisfaction in my office. We do talk a lot about how to get more customers, because attracting customers to our program is the only way to increase customer satisfaction in the first place. Look, you get it? Increasing customer satisfaction is impossible without increasing customers. Whether someone signs up for our free tip of the week, or buys a book for $30, or an audio program for $500, or gets involved in our long-term training contracts, you know, or pays our company millions of dollars to customize a training program, either way, I'm over-delivering. I'm going to over-deliver what's expected. I only concern myself with getting more customers. Then I over-deliver to my clients always. I am most worried about non-customer satisfaction, that is, the people who are dissatisfied because they don't have my product and may not even know they're unhappy. I know that the only dissatisfied clients that we can have are those who don't have my products, or who have them and are not using them correctly, or people that don't know me. We talk about how getting our clients to increase their usage in our material, our books, our programs, our systems, and our processes is the only way to increase customer satisfaction. Not getting a client or having a client use your products incorrectly are bigger outpoints than most of the ways that customer satisfaction is thought of. A customer getting the package a day late is an issue and should be handled. But look, the client who never buys your product suggests you have a real serious customer satisfaction problem because you never made the person a customer in the first place. The first problem you can easily fix. The second one will kill you. I seek out clients who are qualified to do business with us. I then attend to that individual or company until they agree to hire me, knowing that until they get my product or service, they can't be satisfied. This isn't a pitch. This is what I believe to be true. The attainment of the customer, customer insistence, is paramount to customer satisfaction. And customer satisfaction cannot exist without a customer. The attainment of the customer is the most important thing to me. Same thing in relationships. First, it's getting the wife. Then it's keeping her happy. Then it's growing the family. Then it's looking at new ways to keep everyone happy. What was most important? Look, getting the wife was paramount to wife satisfaction. It's impossible for a company to create success by just focusing on customer satisfaction. I believe that the trend of focusing on customer satisfaction has proven to be a detriment to customer acquisition. Companies become so consumed about their supposed customer satisfaction that many are failing to aggressively acquire and expand their market by getting new customers. Customer service is a business term meant to measure how the products and services that companies supply meet or exceed customer expectations after the purchase. This assessment, customer satisfaction, is supposedly a key differentiator between the brands customers follow loyally and those they abandon entirely. Yet most places that I go into never service me enough before the sale to ever acquire me as a customer in the first place. Executives tout the importance of customer service from their ivory towers, yet they forget to promote the attainment, customer assistance, the attainment of the customer to begin with. Most products don't get my attention so completely that I'm compelled to purchase them without the assistance of the company. Unfortunately, most companies and salespeople never bothered to ask the customer to buy when given the opportunity and then fail to follow that opportunity up. Thus, they never make a client. No customer insistence equals no customer satisfaction. We do mystery shopping campaigns like I mentioned earlier for companies and have validated this over and over. The biggest problem with companies today is that they never made a customer in the first place. If you have a subpar offering, a product that doesn't do what you state it will, and that makes people feel like they've been cheated after the purchase, look, the marketplace will dispose of you sooner or later, regardless of your customer satisfaction score. Most people don't fail because they're offering an inferior product or a poor product. Most people fail because they never get enough customers. Does Starbucks offer the very best customer service and coffee available? Hey, I don't know. I do know that the company has made a serious investment in making it easy and convenient for you to buy their coffee. Is Starbucks concerned about people standing in line too long and getting the right coffee and being greeted correctly? Of course. But I assure you, the company is concerned first with the acquirement of the client. Does Google provide the best search engine and the best customer experience and service? Hey, I don't know. Does it look to improve the customer experience? Certainly. But first, it dominates the space so clearly and gets so much attention that it's the first site used. What's my point here? Brands that truly deliver customer satisfaction do not talk about customer service. They focus on customer acquisition. Customer insistence is senior to customer service. Emerging organizations first need people to know about them, then must do everything they can to make them happy. Remember, customer satisfaction cannot exist without a customer first. American corporations have become so obsessed with customer satisfaction that they have lost sight of the first and most vital factor, customer acquisition. Keep the main thing, as they say here in the South. Customer satisfaction should not be an initiative, but something so inherent to an organization that all its attention is focused now on customer acquisition. To garner the attention of a potential customer or market and then fail to capitalize on creating a user of your products and services makes no sense and is the most expensive of mistakes. Yet this is what happens with far too many organizations. Let's say a company successfully gets my attention long enough that I actually consider its products, but then the company doesn't do enough to actually earn my business and shut me down, making me a customer. Look, not being a customer makes it impossible for that company to make me a satisfied customer. I'm just saying, don't put the cart before the horse. Notice how executives become concerned about customer satisfaction and then start initiatives to conduct customer satisfaction surveys of the individuals who became customers, but completely ignore surveying those who never became a customer but wanted to. This is a huge miss and a great example of an only practice, as I discussed in Chapter 10, that you could use immediately on how to acquire more customers. In addition to surveying those you've acquired, garnering input from those who didn't buy from you would actually disclose much more to your company about true customer satisfaction. Don't you want to find out why you didn't acquire the business? You think you didn't satisfy a customer and therefore never made one? Most companies fail not due to lack of quality of their product, service, or their offering. They fail because they don't take enough strategic actions to acquire the client in the first place. That's why I suggest that customer satisfaction is the wrong target, because you don't even get the opportunity to satisfy someone who never evolves into a client in the first place. My point here is not to negate customer satisfaction as an acquisition or as an initiative, but to shift your attention back to the acquisition. Also understand, it is impossible to somehow completely prevent customer complaints. There are, of course, measures you can take to improve your product or service. But when dealing with human beings, let's face it, you are going to get complaints and dissatisfaction. It's just that simple. The best you can do is resolve complaints and dissatisfaction when they emerge, and they will, I promise, and treat them as opportunities to be in communication with your clients. What you need is more people interacting with your product or service and your company. Yes, complaints will increase when dealing with human beings, but so will praise. Increase the number of users of your product or service through massive action, not through massive initiatives that cause your people to back off from the acquisition in the first place. I launched my first company under the naive impression that I would work with a handful, quote unquote, a handful of clients and really, quote unquote, concentrate my attention on them. Thereby, I would elicit, hopefully, great customer satisfaction. I assumed that this would give me an advantage in the market and allow me to deliver quality service and really make a difference. Look, although this was a great idea, it just didn't work out. First of all, this great plan didn't put me on a scale necessary to build a business with a wide enough reach to get me enough attention. And I fell way short of domination, not to mention way short on the cash flow necessary to continue to support the clients. Just as important, it didn't allow me to share my information with enough of the successful people. When I finally got my thinking to the right levels, got off this customer satisfaction binge, and committed to expanding my footprint and taking on 10 times more clients, what I did was I multiplied my exposure tenfold and increased the number of successful people and companies I had previously been avoiding. I shifted my focus to monumental quantities instead of just serving a handful, which enhanced my ability to spread the word about myself, my company, my products, and my ideas to a growing number of people. The grumbles I received did intensify right along with the compliments I received. In fact, I enjoyed more successes than I suffered failures because finally I was exposed to greater numbers of people using my materials. Augmenting the number of attendees at my seminars and workshops actually amplified the number of quality players and clients that I was exposed to and expanded the number of individuals who were then using my ideas and techniques. More people were talking now about my methodologies among their associates who would then spread the word to people they knew and so on. The more people talked about me, the more I was able to expand my footprint to get more attention, acquire more customers, and then create more customer satisfaction. Think about it like this. Would Facebook or Google be better off if they provided their service to only a few people? If they would, I wouldn't even be using them as examples. The practice of customer satisfaction is not limited to how you treat a customer after you acquire them. It should focus on what you do to attain them in the first place. The quality of the client you attain will have a direct effect on the level of customer satisfaction that you can deliver. I'm going to say that again. The quality of the client you attain will have a direct effect on the quality of the level of customer satisfaction experienced. You will not get to quality without seeking quantity. Remember as well what we have discussed in the previous chapters, okay? Criticism and complaints are inevitable indications that you're growing as you should be. Disregard the criticism as a bad thing. Welcome and handle complaints and do everything you can to expand your footprint. The more people you serve, the better your chances are of interacting with quality customers. To be clear, you certainly want to deliver and exceed on the promises you make. Certainly you want great customer satisfaction. However, look, if you're focused on delivering exceptional 10x service prior to acquisition, if you already know you deliver great service and a great product, this part becomes natural after acquisition. Acquire your client. I'm assuming you have a great product, a great idea, a great service, a great investment opportunity. Now you need to increase your support base for that idea. There are, regrettably, thousands of organizations in existence that sell inferior products every day. Although I'm certainly not suggesting that you push substandard offerings or sacrifice your product's quality, I'm trying to highlight an unfortunate reality. Domination of market share trumps all other things. Companies that sell products make acquisition their number one goal. And they better handle any problems with their products or offerings after they get their users on board, or they will cease to exist. No organization in the world has created massive success while limiting the acquisition of new clients. Apple learned this lesson the hard way for too long. It got killed by Microsoft for decades, a company any Apple user will claim sold an inferior product because while Microsoft made its merchandise available to the masses, Apple focused on just a small number of people. Notice the shift that Apple has made in the past few years, making its products appealing to the masses. In 1 year, 3% of all the households in America had an iPad, and 63% are using MP3 players, of which Apple has 45% of that market share. Apple is clearly adopting massive action in a big way these days with the goal of dominating with its footprint. Remember, even if your product and company deliver perfectly, you're going to get complaints from customers because they're human. You can't keep everyone happy all the time. It's impossible. It's a mistake to be scared of complaints. Instead, encourage them, look for them, find them, and then resolve them. Complaints are your customer's very direct way of telling you exactly how to make your product better. If you approach every situation wrought with anxiety about offending a client, then you will never attain dominance.